Okay, this is board time, Wednesday, June 17th at 3:15.
Hi, we don't have any extra staff here, so I guess we can...
John Dunaway is supposed to join us.
Okay.
But when he shows, we can hit 1.1.
All right.
So we just jump to 1.2.
I don't see a letter here for letter.
Okay, so before we get into the letter sending mode, I wanted to give you some feedback. So the suggestion from us, well, I don't think I suggested it, but regarding the Woodland Chamber of Commerce request for $5,000.
For the visitor center?
Yes.
Yes. Well, whatever it's for, it goes to them, and they use it for that. Mm-hmm. So we declined the $5,000, and I think last year we gave them $2,500. So we had a couple board meetings where people said, you know, we're not going to do that anymore. So last week, based in part on the appeal from the lady from Woodland Chamber and her explanation of what they do, we agreed to give $2,500 to them for the visitor's center. And then there was talk about, were we going to try to... find another $2,500 from some other organization for them. And the organization that was recommended or suggested that we look into was Vancouver USA Regional Tourism, which is a 501c4, I think it is. So Kim Bennett runs that, and I'm on that board. I'm new on that board, however. So before any letters got sent, I wanted to call Kim and see if this is something like typically they do. So the information I got from her is that the board policy is they do not fund anybody's chamber at all anymore. In fact, they never have, as far as I can see, going back. The second point was... that there is a lodging tax for both City of Vancouver and for Clark County. The lodging tax that comes in for the Clark County jurisdiction, or to our jurisdiction, doesn't really come to us. It's being used 100% for bonds and debt service.
For
exhibition hall.
Yes. So there is no money from that source, which is their other revenue source. They also get TPA money, tourism promotion area money, which is an assessment from hotels. It's a state fund, and they have 13. They have a board of hoteliers who review that funding and have indicated that what they want that, because that comes, they're the revenue source for that, that they use their revenue to increase not visitation into Clark County, but increasing overnight stays. So it's not casual traffic that drives in to from Portland across the bridge. It's they're in the hotel business. They want people in room nights. So those are the two main revenue sources, and that's their mission, and they have some constraints on that money. So that's what I wanted to report back. And if years ago, they did give some money to, because I asked if they'd ever given money to visitor centers. And she said that the visitor center that was in the historic reserve, they did that up to about 3 years ago as part of a local contract with I don't know if it was the Historic Reserve in general, but now the fort has taken over that responsibility for the visitor center, and so they don't support visitor centers any longer. So it's not part of their mission. Some of the money can't legally be directed that way. And the other, the lodging tax money is going to, did you say the exhibition center?
Right.
She identified it as bonds and debt service.
Right.
Yeah, for a county.
Right. We borrowed $18 million to build the exhibition hall, and we use three sources of revenue to pay the debt service on that. It's the over-the-cap revenue that we get from the Vancouver Downtown Authority.
Okay.
The hotel and motel
5%
tax. Yeah. Pardon?
2%?
3%. Yeah. And it, above 97%, we get that.
Yeah.
And then the amphitheater pays us rent.
Yeah.
So those three sources of revenue meet our debt service needs every year for the exhibition hall.
Okay. Debt service and bond repayment.
Well, it's principal and interest.
Yes. Gotcha. So I don't recommend sending her a letter. I think we have the information we would have wanted to know. And it was not Woodland Chamber's idea to do that. We were kind of taking it upon ourselves. Mm-hmm. Is there any place we could scare up the money? Somebody recommended this organization, and this isn't feasible.
Well,
so is there any... They were still asking for $5,000, and personally, I don't recommend we give them more than the $2,500 out of county funds.
We already... Well, go ahead, Tom.
One of the things I noticed is that under the tourism, USA Tourism for Vancouver, that they have somewhere in the vicinity of $1.5 million. Now, we might have to double check that. That's something I recall, and I'm just having a tough time figuring out where they're spending that money.
I cannot tell you the number of people who come to me and say that Vancouver Tourism USA or USA Tourism has a big reserve, and we want to get our mitts on some of that money. I cannot tell you the number of people that have come to me and said, you're on that board, I want some of that money. So that money has accrued over time, because what they do is long-term marketing initiatives. And they had some of those out on the street, so to speak, and the recession hit. And when the recession hit, they were living pillar to post financially, and they could not maintain those initiatives they'd started. So since about 2007, they have started to accrue reserves so that when they start an advertising initiative, it's like, I don't know about advertising, but the theory is you start it, you put it out, then you re-advertise it, and you do that at least three times. You don't say it once, you say it three times. So they have maintained their reserves so that when they start an initiative, they can continue it. What they're doing now, and this is as of the meeting this morning, they are starting now to draw down their reserves by increasing their marketing for the area. And they do marketing. They do promote events in Woodland at no cost to Woodland in their official travel magazine, which they publish 95,000 copies of. And Woodland sends them their events.
Uh-huh.
And they do free advertising in that book for them, as they do for the other cities, for anybody who's got something special going on. So those kinds of initiatives, like producing that book. And I think it was smart and frugal that they accrued some reserves so they wouldn't find themselves in that position again. But everybody who hasn't done that sees that money is out there and wants their, quote, share. And believe me, Woodland Chamber, if we think Woodland Chamber, I have a couple other people that have come to me to have a friendly lunch, which I thought was the joy of my personality, only to find out they're going, hey, you're on that board. You know, they got a lot of money over there. I want to get some of that. Can you use your influence? So I think we can talk about if we have another 2,500, but it really, it that doesn't seem fair because we've gone out of the funding of the Chambers of Commerce. And we've withdrawn our participation, and I think on a one-time basis that we did for them, it is a dynamic group. It is part of the county. It, you know, they do have a visitor center. I think that we did it one final time is to our credit, but I don't think we want to look for another 2,500 because if we do that, then everything we said we weren't going to do anymore, which is put money through people's chambers, whatever they use it for.
One of the things that was impressive was the number of people that went through
their
tourism. That is all run by volunteers.
And
they've upgraded that with money from Cowlitz County as well as Woodland and the chambers and. And I guess one of the things that is misguiding when we say we're asking them to give it to the chamber is actually for the tourism. The chamber is the one that is able to receive the money to keep the place, to keep the doors. So I think they have two salaried employees at minimum wage.
Yeah.
Everybody else was volunteers. So I think that they're a real asset to Clark County, that we do benefit from them. And while we may not give them the full $5,000, I would hate to give them any less than that. And then it comes to mind what Mark had showed me here, that we pay for part of the exhibit hall is paid through other three sources, but yet when the fairgrounds and exhibit hall didn't have enough to pay the rent, we took it out of the general fund, many times $300,000, and made up the difference. So now when we had this big successful year where we made $600,000. What do we do with that money then? Is that still part of the general fund then? Yes, it would be.
Well, because although the fair was very successful, you have to remember that the other two components of the event center are not money makers. The exhibition hall itself doesn't make money, and the horse arena doesn't make money. So you have to net them all together. Then the gain was much smaller.
It wasn't $600,000?
No.
$300,000?
No, I think it might have been
$100,000. So what did we do with that tourism money if we didn't have to spend it there?
Well, this money, the tourism money, is dedicated to debt service. So we can't move that.
We didn't have any debt service because they made a profit.
No, we owe $1 million a year at least in debt service on the exhibition hall. We have a debt service schedule.
I thought it was $600,000.
No.
And we got in trouble because we reduced the amphitheater by half.
No, the debt service is more than $1 million a year. And, you know, you make an interest-only payment, and then you make an interest payment with principal. And it comes to, it varies slightly year to year, but it's usually $1.25 million, like $1,025,000 or so. And so these revenues, we were concerned because during the recession, the over-the-cap revenue and the motel and hotel tax revenues dropped rather significantly, and we cut the amphitheater rent at about the same time. Yeah. Fortunately, we had a big reserve in the fund, 1026, that we used to make the debt service payments. And so a combination of these revenues, although reduced, plus a little bit of fund balance every year, got us through the rough times. And we also planning to use REIT to cover any shortage. But we
got the REIT into the general fund.
But we never did have to use the REIT.
But because we for the last 3 years, well, 3 years prior to this, we were fund kicking up about $300,000 to pay the rest of the bills.
Well, there was a one-time transferred to the fairgrounds of $1 million, because they accumulated a rather large deficit. The board voted to eliminate that, and they also voted a $250,000 a year annual subsidy.
I remember that. I'd like to have Bob bring us up to date on that.
Sure.
I thought what we wrote off was like $600,000 or $700,000.
It was a full million, and then $250,000 a year thereafter.
But then either I was told different, or
no,
or I sure have a short memory. So
it's been the same.
So we'd like to see that.
Sure.
Come back, brings up to date as to where we're going with that.
Sure.
That's a lot of money.
It'd be a good refresher, and when we look at, that's where you'll see the revenue source that I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That is completely earmarked for that. You'll see that, and then the bigger picture, because they're the principal or the bonds, and those will have different payout schedules. I mean, all bonds aren't due at the same time, so they're scheduled.
Well, there's only one debt issuance. It was just one big one.
But even a single issuance, the bonds will mature at different times.
No, these all mature at the same time.
Something where all the bonds matured exactly the same date and time.
We went out.
One lump of money.
We borrowed $18 million, one bond, and it matures. All of it matures at the same time. You want the debt service schedule, I'll get it for you.
Yeah.
Wasn't the amphitheater rent $700,000?
Well, the amphitheater rent increases every 5 years. It was to increase $100,000 every 5 years, but when the reduction was granted, the every 5 year increase was reduced to $50,000. I think right now they're paying $400,000 or $450,000.
Yeah, because 3 or 4 years ago they paid $350,000.
Right. Yeah.
So we reduced it about $300,000.
Whatever it was, yeah. I think it was $700,000. We reduced it by $350,000.
My memory's not bad.
Yeah.
Not that bad.
But
the point's well taken, that it would be good to see that on a document to refresh our memory.
Okay. We're talking about $2,500 for a visitor center in Woodland, and now I'm producing debt service schedules and other things. How interesting.
We wonder where all that money went.
I couldn't grieve.
You know, I can't afford $2,500.
All I'm talking about is $2,500. I'm saying if you do that list, I'd like a copy.
I would, sure. Can we ever get a budget thing from Vancouver Tourism USA?
Get a what?
I'd like to see where they spend their $1.5 million.
Revenue budget, expense budget, I think.
They have something.
I get
like
it.
That.
I have one.
Can you share it with us?
Sure.
Great. Sure,
yeah.
I got a few points to make. It's a good thing.
Oh, I'm sorry. We didn't mean to leave you out.
Oh, you didn't.
Okay.
I just wait until you guys are done.
Go ahead. First,
I want to make the point that we are being consistent with our policy that we are no longer giving money to any chamber of commerce. The difference that we, refresh me from our conversation, our decision last board meeting on this, what is unique about this is that we're not just giving the Woodland Chamber of Commerce money to do with whatever. Instead, it's specifically only to be used for the tourism or the visitor center, because we closed we don't have a visitor center. It used to be, and now it's closed down. And the intention behind that is to put heads in beds, is to bring people to the area to visit Mount St. Helens and Officers Row and the attractions for our area. So the visitor center is the focus there. The Vancouver Tourism Bureau, I understand they have a policy that they don't fund chambers of commerce, so do we. I think it's really important that we ask the right question make the right point, ask the right question for the right reason, because I do believe that the Vancouver Tourism Board has some discretion that would, this relatively small amount, to match our example. If we say it's not for Chamber of Commerce, it's for the regional visitor center to help people come to our area, tourists, and for that reason, we all win if we do this simple support. We might be able to get a more positive response.
So,
I like it is deceiving, because, and I don't remember how she stated why it's given to the chamber, but it's part of their
they
budget.
Run it.
Well, the chamber runs.
They run it, but she made it clear that this was for the. In fact, we have to ensure that when we send this check, that we also make sure that that's clear what it is for, so they don't just say, "Hey, we got this. We can use it for the visitor center if we want to." No, it's only for the visitor center.
I don't think anybody would take that away from Darlene. She's a strong person, a healthy lady.
Yeah, she does really well. So you were going to say something?
I'm not going to say anything right this minute.
Tom, you got something to say?
No.
Okay.
I kind of like where we're going. So we're going to hold off on the letter.
Mark, didn't we authorize last meeting $2,500 for the visitor center?
We did.
Yeah, we did.
Okay, so that's a done deal.
That's a done deal.
Okay. And just make sure that when we communicate to them that they're going to reconfirm back to us that was for the visitor center, not just for the chamber.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the representative from the organization made it very clear in last week's meeting that money is used strictly for that facility. But certainly we can reiterate that point when we dispatch the check.
Okay. So maybe there is another entity. I think maybe the fort might be interested, or for us to be able to somehow, since we're leading by example for the one regional tour visitor center, I like the idea that Jeannie had to see who else can we approach to say, can you help share?
I don't think it's our responsibility to go out and approach. I think if Woodland Chamber wants to, and that is a powerful woman that runs that chamber. She is very powerful in the community, and she's very powerful politically. I respect every aspect of that. But if our policy is that this year we're giving them $2,500 to sustain a visitor center, and they need $5,000, I think it's their job to go out and try to see where they can get that. And for us to take that on, really implies that we want somebody to come up with that money. The reason that we would interject ourselves is because we want them to have another $2,500 and we don't want to give it, and we want to start putting the heat on somebody else to get it for them. And I don't think that's a correct position for us to be in.
Well, I think she made it very, very clear that we are one of the low-end donors to the tourism. But tourism is big. It's really very, very big. It creates jobs, and we are about creating jobs, seasonal or whatever. So there's a positive aspect to it. I think our role would be that we...
So there is a state tourism board.
Hmm?
There is a state tourism agency.
I sat on that. Board. I sat on that.
Well,
and that money goes down to the locals, just like you reported.
Well, so does the state have grant money for something like a state?
The state itself pretty much cut off the tourism money. So the only thing that's left is the hotel motel tax.
Well, why don't we do this? It sounds like we've pretty much saturated that one. So it sounds like we've already decided to give them $2,500 last week for the visitor center, and you already had the communication with the Vancouver Tourism Board, and you're not optimistic that it would be fruitful. And you're right in that they're very they have good leadership there to head that up. So we can move on. Is that okay?
Yes.
All right. All right.
Okay, John.
So, John Dunaway, you want to jump back to 1.1 here on the fireworks?
Certainly. Good afternoon, councilors.
1.2.
From 1.1 to 1.2. I mean, 1.2 to 1.1.
County manager asked me to look into the fireworks issue as a result of some emails and phone calls I believe the board's office has received about for the dryness. So
I'm not familiar with any of those, so Can someone characterize the nature of those?
It's very dry. Fireworks.
Fire hazards.
Fireworks burn things. My neighbor has a lot of tall grass that he neglects, and okay. if a bottle rocket goes in there, my house might burn down.
So it's a safety issue, mm-hmm. and it's because of how dry things are, and it's a fire issue.
Right, and John already moved up the burn ban 2 weeks, did you?
Yes, we normally implement an outdoor burning ban on July 15th. We're doing it July 1st this year, just to stay ahead of that curve. And that press release has been put out. Folks are reading that, and they're getting concerned about the dryness with fireworks season coming up, with sales going on starting June 28th. So it's the first time we've really looked into the possibility of an early or by banning fireworks at all on an emergency basis. So looking into that, I called the Washington State Fire Marshal's office, and they've gotten other jurisdictions who have asked about it. I don't think anybody's ready to do it, but they are inquiring about it. The answer is there really is no legal way for us locally, or right now, for us to ban fireworks at all. The state law, as you might recall from a fireworks discussion before, gives local counties and cities the ability to implement laws that restrict the sale and the use, dates and times, and the types of devices. Those types of laws have to be in effect 1 year before they can, or have to be passed 1 year before they become effective locally. Because we don't have anything on our county ordinance that says we have the ability to make it an emergency ban on the use of fireworks, there's nothing in the law that says we can, which is surprising. But that's what I'm hearing back from the state, and that's what I'm hearing back from some of the other jurisdictions who have looked. So I think if that's something we would like to be able to do in the future, I think we need to put that ordinance together so it is on the books for a year before it becomes effective, and then we can have that tool to draw from later. But as it stands right now, we don't have that ability.
One of the things that we did last year, we took on one of the most restrictive fireworks regulations more than any city in Clark County. And for us to continue to do more than any city doesn't really make sense. For us to go out and continue to do more.
Well, this would just be for this year, and it would only be on an emergency basis if we took that step, or whatever the council would like to do. What the question was, can we just, because of the conditions for 1 year only, or whenever we need to, can we ban the fireworks use locally? And the answer, until we pass that law in our county ordinance, is no. We don't have the ability to do that. Starting next year, our use south of 219th Street will be July 4th only, which will reduce that window, which I think is what you're referring to. The emergency ban ability isn't on the books currently.
So you're responding to a citizen request, not a county councilor request.
No, there were a number of emails.
No, I didn't request it.
There were a number of emails that came to the board. I just thought it would be prudent, since between now and the 4th, you may get a flood of these, that you know exactly where we stand and what we're able to do regarding the interest of the public in banning these things.
So basically it's not an option.
And beyond that, is there any interest in having John pursue an ordinance change to get language in there that would give the county the ability to ban if conditions are so severe that fire risk is just too high?
I have to say, I don't have enough experience with the county and the jurisdiction and what's been done in the past. I'm not up to speed on the issue. It would seem to me any county ought to be able to have the authority to do an emergency ban. And it might be this year, or if we have dry conditions, we could have these hang around for a year or two. That's not unusual when you go into kind of a drought period. I do know that from the FUS and the public hearings that we had at the Vancouver City Council, there's only two kinds of people: those that love fireworks and those that hate them. And the testimony, depending on the night, would be just 90%, you know, one way or the other. So people have strong feelings about it being part of the celebration of the 4th of July, part of a family tradition, part of the tradition of celebration, and other people are fearful. They're fearful about their animals. They're very fearful of fire. And I'm in the camp that before fireworks start, I go out and clean all my gutters because I get pine needles accumulating. So I'm sort of the fire hazard mind, but I don't really know the culture of Clark County in the way that you would know it.
This surely isn't the first dry year we've had. And I hate to make a policy based on a single dry year. I think what we have on the books is sufficient. And I guess somewhere along the way, there has to be some. There's a lot of responsible people that can make their own judgment, and I hate to keep putting on more regulations for what if maybe we should do things. So I wouldn't be there.
Okay. Vancouver is spending, I guess, substantial money advertising, billboards, TV ads, a bunch of things. So they're educating people for safety,
right?
And that all that covers the county basically, because that's how the coverage works. So I would say I don't want to spend money on that, but whatever means that we have, be able to help educate, in other words, signs, and work with as you work with each of the fireworks stands to encourage them to be able to help people to I'm sure you have a list of tips. Keep a bucket of water handy, keep your hose ready, clean things up, be mindful, have lunch, the buddy system, those kind of things. I assume that messaging, you have some specific things that you can do on your own without requiring anything from us, right?
Yes, every year we put out a press release urging people to be safe and giving them ways to do that, mm-hmm. Tips on how to use fireworks if they're going to. Ultimately, we encourage them to go see a public display and not use, but if they're going to use, here are some of the things you can do to protect yourself and your property.
Mm-hmm.
We will continue to do that, and we'll work with the PIO's office to make sure that message gets out. I've also, this week, we're going through our pile of fireworks permit. We permit the fireworks stands every year. We talk with those folks, and I'm having conversations with them now, as we will when we inspect them on the 28th before they open.
Mm-hmm.
Talk up the folks that are buying. Make sure they understand the dangers and what they can be doing to make it to mitigate that a little bit. We might also be able to put some flyers together, although I don't know how long they would last on the stand. It depends on how busy the season is, with some of those tips that they can throw in a bag with the fireworks when they sell the fireworks.
Yeah.
So folks take that message home.
Yeah, I expect that the fireworks industry, those that sell fireworks, and the nonprofits that provide such a revenue source for them, they understand that it's in their best interest for citizens not to go out and start fires with those, because next year likely there's going to be the talk of the demand for bans, so that doesn't happen again.
Right.
So their motivation to help their customers to be proactive and safe, I assume that they'd be very cooperative with you. Probably the most what I'm thinking is a specific list of things that would be handy, that would be maybe more than just no-brainer stuff, that would help them to think, oh yeah, that's a really good idea, I hadn't thought of that kind of thing, you could potentially, as you're going to touch bases with all these fireworks selling stands, you can say, and here's, you guys can copy these. This is our form. You can download it from our web, and here it is, just to make it easy.
Okay. Good idea.
Okay. Any more discussion on that? Okay.
Good.
Move on. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Okay. Tom, you got the next three ones. 2.1, 2, and 3.
The one we've already covered, so I'm going to go back and cover one on a chairman, a first spokesman. Under the charter, I also talked to legal staff and to Mark McCauley about this. Sometimes we either don't communicate to the press or we give mixed messages to the press. Under the charter, the chairman is a spokesman for the board and exhibits and is supposed to speak in behalf of the board. And my thinking is that we should implement that now instead of later. Some of the arguments that we wouldn't start now is that we didn't have an elected chairman. But yet you have to realize that all three of us were elected countywide. And we do have a chairman, and we still have the responsibility of getting the message out to the press as to what the board is doing and where the board has landed in unanimous decision, a majority decision. And so we stay on message and include the press in that information, whether it be a press release, agreed upon, or something like that. I wanted to bring it up to see what your feelings were about it. We've had, like I said before, some mixed messages, some lack of contact with the press, and I think it's our obligation to make that contact, and in doing so that we would do a better job on the messaging if we did that through the chairman, as the charter asks that we do, dictates that we do.
Well, I think any counselor can communicate with any member of the press whenever they choose at their prerogative. So I'm assuming that what you mean is that if we take a joint review of something and that we develop a consensus, that if it's going to be formally communicated to the press, mm-hmm. that it goes through the eyes of the chair.
Yeah, and that way the chair can say, as a representative of the board, that way it's not necessarily your quote, it's what we have done as a board, and that's the message that we give. Now, I guess I don't know to what degree the charter just says that the chairman is the spokesman for the group, and we're supposed to be implementing those things as of January 1. Now, the discretion was, do we have an elected chair and we do it now, or is our chair, you know, you're appointed, that we appoint you and you are elected? So I think it would help in our communication with the press.
So, Tom, I've read the charter no less than 6 times, and I do know that there is a section in there that talks about if someone is communicating the formal final opinion of the board, how that's done, that it's somehow the chair's involved with that. I would like to get the whole section of the charter and the context it's offered in before we continue the discussion, because I need to see it, how it's organized in the structure to know.
And I think it's important that I bring this up now so that we could work on it, talk about it, research it. Is that what you have there?
I do. 2.2 organization. The council member nominated and elected countywide shall be the chair of the council. The charter contemplates only one person being nominated and elected countywide, and that will be whoever's selected as the chair this coming November. That person does not exist now.
That's what we disagreed.
Right, but Councilor Madore has already spoken with Chris Horn about this and got an opinion on his own effort.
I would have wanted to know that too.
Now you share that with me. I didn't know you.
Now, past practice has been that the chair is slightly elevated above his peers by being nominated as a chair. He runs board meetings, he runs board time, and typically the other counselors defer on certain matters. But the powers enumerated and responsibilities enumerated in here, I think, go a bit farther than what exists currently.
What does it say?
Well, it says the chair shall preside over council meetings, which we already do, and ensure the orderly and efficient conduct of council meetings. The chair or his or her designee will be the county spokesperson to articulate county policies, visions, strategies, and plans, represent the county before the governor, state legislature, and other state and federal agencies, meet and greet important visitors, supervise constituent response processes for the council as a whole, and serve as the county's lead representative at dedication, ceremonial activities, and other public events.
Okay, I already see a terrible weakness in that, and that is they should designate the reviewed and adopted policies and whatever. There's a point of vagueness in there that it could be someone who's the chair representing their own policies or goals. So, I mean, those are things we need to iron out. And I don't think we necessarily need to rewrite the charter, although I think we can offer amendments for clarity.
Right.
What we're talking about there is so important. I agree. Well,
Chris Horn has recommended on a number of occasions that the board begin to promulgate a set of rules for the governing of board activities.
Yes. And but, you know, I want to be careful about that, too, because I have been in an organization where there's a rule for virtually everything, which only manages and controls the electeds to the point they have no individual conscience or prerogative. And that's the very thing that I will fight to the death here, because what it does is take it, it eliminates the need for elected people altogether. And it doesn't correct elected officials that we disagree with. All it does is eliminate their ability to ever do anything, and then why even have them? So I don't, as this is the most important part of the charter to me, is not seizing control from you by a board, and not having you seize control from the board for your managerial, but to have there be a balance. And I've talked about that since day one. And so I don't want to see us develop a set of rules that tie our hands. If it's to facilitate effective communication and that sort of thing, that's only sensible. But we just need to be so careful, because I sat there as the city council did that, and I will tell you it killed all personal initiative, mm-hmm. all incentive, all everything.
Well, that's kind of what the charter does.
Well, I think the charter doesn't have to do that. I think
it does say that. At the first of the year, we would have to change it.
I think the charter allows us to make some clarification. There's some part of the charter that allows us, through some mechanism, to make reasonable if not amendments, clarifications. I believe it's in there. I'll read it number 7 times.
Well, we can make changes or amendments, and it can be challenged. 100 signatures means it goes on the ballot.
But if we're asking for is a change that simplifies and creates balance, I can't imagine who would want to challenge that.
A lot of people.
I don't know.
Yeah, they do. So
they would get their say when it would mm-hmm. go to a hearing.
Yeah. One more concern of mine is that you would think that the majority of the board would also be able to overrule the chairman, and I don't think that's in there.
Say again.
The majority of the board, when there's five of us here,
yeah.
The majority of that board should be able to overrule the chairman. So like today, we can overrule the chairman.
Well,
no, I don't think that would change.
That'll be the same.
I think it doesn't
specify that.
No, but we're a democracy, and we are majority rule. And it, as with anything we take up mm-hmm. during consent hearings, if we have a 2-to-1 vote, mm-hmm. the two votes prevail. So if the chair has a particular action they want to undertake, and the other four counselors don't want to go that way, then the motion or the
anybody who gets outvoted doesn't get what they want.
Part of it, in the definition, what you read was very specific. What he does, we may not agree with what he is doing. So therefore, we might want to address this in a more formal fashion, that the majority can overrule the chairman, because under the definition that you read, we cannot.
No, and that is a change, because currently Chairman Madore serves at the pleasure of the other two, because you, at the beginning of the year, appointed him as the chair. Mm-hmm. With a vote, you could also remove him, and I recall back when Commissioner Stewart was here, there was some threat.
Do I hear a motion?
There was some threat to do that at one point. That ability disappears when we have an elected chair. The only people who can remove the elected chair are the voters.
So that's hence my wording.
Okay.
My suggested addition to that statement, if we're able to do that, that the board would formulate our vision. By majority rule, we would approve that. And what else did it say, that the chairman will communicate?
Council policies, vision, strategies, and plans.
And so all of that we would review, we would approve them. It would be the majority that approve it. And if it doesn't get approved, then it's not part of what the chairman defines as approved.
It has to be in a fashion to amend the charter.
Well, maybe we need to define our questions and then have Chris Horn come in and talk to us.
I got you all thinking about it now. That was the most important thing. If we're done with that, Mr. Chairman,
It's kind of a segue into another part.
There's another part that's a gray area, and it's very, very concerning to me, because we are responsible for the budget. And I've had this discussion with Mark already and expressed my concerns. And my concern is that we're responsible for the budget. And what affects the budget is negotiations, number of employees, and things that we have. But one of the policy that we used to have is that we authorized all the filling of the positions. So as a position came available, we would review that and decide whether that needed to be filled right away, whether there's a reevaluation of that position, and so on. And then at that point, the administrator would go forward and interview and release that to HR, and they would interview and hire the person. What that does, it gives us a pulse as to how the county's doing. Do we have a turnover of employees? Why are they turning over? Are they unhappy? Are they attrition, retiring, or going someplace else? I think that's part of policy making, as to the having a pulse of what the county is doing, and you get a pulse from that. One of the things that was very disturbing is that in the last 6 years, I don't recall any time of ever having more than 4 vacancies at one time. Today we have over 24 on the advertising for positions. Granted, some of those include a couple in the sheriff's department and a couple other elected officials department. But the number is there. First thing that goes through my mind is, why do we have this many? Are these people unhappy with us? Are they unhappy with pay scale? Are we going through a nutrition thing? We can't plan or make policy to address this unless we know why. And that's what that used to do. That used to come with a piece of paper and it would say, this is the position, this is the grade, this is the person that's leaving it, and why they left, and what would happen if we didn't fill that position right away. All that information was there, and we would discuss that at that time. And that was really key in getting a real handle on our policy when we went forward and did the balancing of the budget. That was very influential in that. So I see that as a gray area. It's really not addressed, and I think it's essential that we talk about that and maybe adopt that policy, because it is not mentioned. It does mention that my manager is in charge of hiring. All I want is the authorization to fill the position, and that way we could review it. And in fact, many times an administrator or manager would come back and say, the department head or the manager of this department wants to change the qualifications of this job and upgrade it or downgrade it. So.
Okay. Jeannie?
I'm not altogether certain about us giving the county manager the authority to fill a job. I think per the charter, I don't know, that might be right at a boundary there. But I agree entirely with you that it is important that we keep our hand or finger on the pulse of staff turnover, and by that I mean information about jobs that are opening, or if we delete a job.
Add, and that's important.
Or add a job, or if we're doing reclassifications. And if we know why someone is leaving, I do think that's important. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how often we know that. People aren't required to do an exit interview. Usually, unless you do an exit interview, you're not sure. You might surmise, they might mention, so you might have that. So the idea to me is to keep a sense of employee morale, keep a sense of what kind of turnover, keep a sense by number of new job postings of as economically things are improving, that puts a demand on more county services. And then we can have an issue with staff morale because of number of hours somebody has to work.
We already have that.
Well,
in juvenile, yeah.
So, and what I would want is an opportunity for a discussion with the manager and tell us what's up, what's your observation, what's going on here. Now, how often does that report come out?
We did that every week. So, for example, at board time, it comes to board time.
Yeah.
And it was in the manager's packet, and he would have the request from the department, and they had the criteria that they had to fill out to show Mark, and then Mark would show it, would hand it all out and explain the criteria for each job, and 99 times out of 100, yes, it was, but it was good. We knew if it was a transfer. One of the things we promote now promotion from within. So a lot of times you have a promotion up, so they have to fill a position. Those are real positive things. The other thing is that people retire, so it tells you why they retire. Okay. Then the criteria, like a good example I always use, not real accurate, if you had a vacancy of a truck driver, it happened long about November, December, we would delay that for 2 to 3 months, filling that position, because we didn't need that position. It wasn't so critical if the construction wasn't going on. So it's not only do you save the wages, the cost of the wages, it's the health care and all the benefits that go with it. That's how we balance the budget.
But those same concerns would be the concerns the city manager or the county manager would have, too.
I don't know if you get those from the departments now or not.
But you'd be concerned about the timing of hiring. in regards to how it fits into the current year budget, including benefits and all that. So you would be mindful of that too, the same as we might be thinking about that. But
in fact, we have a conscious strategy to for parks maintenance and for highway construction workers. We use seasonal employees to the degree that we can, and we hire them right before we need them, and then they're let go right after we don't need them. And there are seasonal variations that are less dramatic than that. But we save when positions go vacant, there is a lag time. It's called hire lag. And frequently you don't know somebody's leaving. They tell you, "I'm leaving in 2 weeks." Okay? And so then you pull out the job description and you do all your work to make sure that the position is still valid in its current form. Would you like to take the position and do something else with it? And by the time you get all that done and you advertise and you do the interviewing and so on, it may be 60 to 120 days before you have somebody in the position. In the case of Bill Wright, in the case of Steve Schulte, very important people to our program who announce six months in advance that they're leaving.
God.
And they do that as a courtesy to the organization so that you can plan in advance, recruit early, maybe get somebody in 3 weeks before they leave so they can do a mind meld like Dr. Spock. So we do save a significant amount of money through the vacancy process.
So, to Tom's point, I think that a list of new hires or, you know, where did this position come from? Is it an existing? Did somebody leave? And then if we had an idea why they left, and, you know, you can't get an exact answer always, but we can get a general sense of that. That would be helpful to me because if we're finding times where we have a lot of new positions, that means our workload is increasing.
Well, maybe I have a bad manager.
Well,
not you. I'm a foreman.
That's his job to find a bad manager.
The thing is that we don't recruit for any position that hasn't been previously approved by the board. Every time we approve a budget, there is the salaries and benefits budget is built based on positions approved by the board, with the exception of project positions that are short-term in duration. So when we send out the job opportunity email on Friday, I don't know if you've ever opened one of those to see what positions are available, but every week, so that our own employees know what opportunities are available, we share that with everyone. Every one of those positions has been approved in the budget, and so the board has already said that's a worthwhile. Well, not individually. I mean, you haven't looked at each job description, but it was blessed in December. And so when it becomes vacant, then we should be able to review it and validate it and then post it. Now, the vacancy review process was created in 2009, I believe, when the county's fund balance dropped and we had to lay off 262 employees, and the board at that time was very concerned about fiscal stability, bond ratings, and all of that.
You have to be more specific. There's 262 positions.
Not employees.
170 bodies.
Yeah.
And we went after those empty positions and took them back, too. Remember that? So if someone had a position not filled for more than a year, if it's vacant for more than a year, we would take that back away from the department. So there's many things like that we did to keep control. So what I'm asking in this here that we consider making a policy to do that again. It's a gray area. It's not spoken to in the charter, and I think it's a very important that we do that and have that dialogue.
So do you have a copy of that report like you used to get?
Well, I was going to ask you, do you have any of those? Are there a form or an example that we could use? They're really cool. They're really neat.
I can produce one.
I was just thinking someone that would have been reviewed sometime in the past so I could see if that information would matter to me in my opinion.
And quite honestly, because of our fund balance policy and our debt policy and the fact that we Moody's came in when we did the bond refunding and we got a great rating, we're maintaining our reserves. We haven't had to raise taxes. That we're doing such a good job managing this organization financially that I didn't believe that we needed to scrutinize at the board level every hire. And
I'm still not convinced that we do, but I'd like to see just a copy of the report so I could say, would this mean anything to me if I could see it? If I had that report.
Now, there's no, I'm not aware of a report, but you're looking for an example of a vacancy request.
And the reason I brought this up is that for the last 3 months, we've had over 24 jobs postings that we've never had before. What is happening?
We have an eye recruitment system. I can produce week by week the number of vacancies that we posted online. I will produce that and share it with you.
I would like to go one step farther and have a consideration of doing that form again when the vacancy, when we know of the vacancy, that we take a look at that. Sometimes we get a good notice. We don't just get 2 weeks all the time. So,
can I say something here?
Yeah.
The implementation of the charter we have to do. And early on when we were first talking about the process that was going to be thoughtful and that we would all be on the same page, we would work together as a team, and we all agreed that we will implement it, but in an orderly way. That nothing will change unless we as a team agree with a heads up, we're going to change this process. Otherwise, everything was going to remain the same. And they needed a change, but that orderly process of saying, this is what we're going to do, rather than discover that something significant changed, and we discover it after the fact. Remember that discussion, Mark?
I do.
Okay. Here's, I would not have known this change, and this is a really big change that affects the budget turnback, had we not discovered that there are multiple pages of new job openings that weren't there before. So I feel like there's some catching up that needs to be done because we didn't work together as a team in order to make that change. The process and the practice used to be that, and you can correct me if I'm misunderstanding, there is a vacancy. Well, first of all, we always approved the maximum number of FTEs. You couldn't go over that, but it was our practice to quite often be significantly under that. So we authorized up to a certain amount. And anytime there was a vacancy, there was a vacancy review committee that was just simply behind the scenes of the staff. They would go through the process and deliberate and consider, is this the smartest thing to do? Should we just simply refill that position, or should we consider the Division of Labor to be a little bit different, assign duties as an opportunity to make some corrections within the department? We weren't involved with that, but your staff was involved in that. If that vacancy request made it through that committee, then it finally made it to the county administrator, and then the county administrator would present it to the board with a form that says, here's the position, here's why it exists, and here's why we need it, and here's the consequence that would happen if we didn't fill that. All of that was in place, but all of that now is gone, and what we have now is we discover that there's much, much easier now because it's like full discretion. There's no even oversight on our part, not even any awareness that we could be increasing the total number of FTEs that we had. A certain number of FTEs that were there that all of a sudden were bumping up a couple dozen more than we had before, even though, yes, there, the maximum number is authorized, but we're growing much faster now. I assume that we don't have that many people leaving, that we're just simply, there's surely some of them. But to me, this, I don't know enough at this point, Mark. I would ask this. There's no substitute for us working together as a team. There's no substitute for us to be able to be on the same wavelength communicating. We have the responsibility to ensure that we keep our finger on the pulse of the purse strings, the amount of budget turned back, that each position that we filled, which represents typically $100,000 per person per year, when you think you figure salary and benefits, those are big decisions, and it could end up costing this, just those two pages could end up being affecting the budget turn back by millions of dollars this year. I'm not comfortable at all being in the dark and not even having a conversation with you about these positions. Certainly, you mentioned that we don't review every hire. At this point, we're not reviewing any hire. And to me, I feel like when I go back and I to that same senior neighborhood, and that grandma stands up and she says, "I can hardly afford to keep my home because of my property taxes," I want to say to grandma, "I'm aware, and we're working together as a team, and at least we're communicating so that we are considering any time we're going to add another $100,000 per person, that we'll sit down, we're aware of it, and I'm on the same wavelength. We've got a good, thrifty county manager who knows how to get things done. Our job is to equip him with everything he needs to succeed, but we're on the same wavelength because he's not a big spender. He'll get stuff done, and he knows how to stretch the dollars so that we're not overstressing our staff, but we're also saving where we can." So all of that adds up to me, Mark, that we can't have just simply just an unchecked, unaware process where we're bumping up to the maximum number of authorized FTEs. We have some catching up to do. And so I ask you, Mark, before you actually fill those positions that are actually there and being advertised, it's really hot and important, and in my eyes, urgent that you sit down with each of us and help us understand. And hopefully we'll each be able to understand with these positions that are open and say, "Yeah, okay, that makes sense, that makes sense, that makes sense." And maybe we'll end up having a couple of them, we have questions, and we'll talk about those exceptions that may pop out. But that would be a whole lot better to make sure that those kind of checks and balances happen. That's short of a policy that says, here's a formal process you need to go through, because yes, the charter authorizes the county manager to hire and fire, but it gives all budget authority to the board, and that policy that has to do with what do we do for temporary employees, what do we do for project employees, what do we do for vacancy requests, what do we do for any of those things, those are all, we can define those as budget policies and specifications. We're not there yet. It would take time to be able to come up with a policy like that, but the first thing we ought to do is sit down and understand what these vacancies are and make sure that we don't end up filling some just because we had no oversight over the last couple months.
Well, I always go back to the program that we had before. Instead of including it on a one-on-one, we brought it in here, and if two of the three board members said go ahead, fill the position, it would take a no less than two votes to do that. I would recommend that because the program was so self-explanatory that would be a real easy place to go back to.
Well, an observation.
Yeah.
In the 15 months from September 11th, when I started sitting in that chair, to the end of 2014, I can't remember how many vacancy requests I brought to the board, but one of them was not filled of all of those. And then I think of the administrative burden that we put on our managers to type up this form, to make justifications to hire, you know, public health nurses, highway maintenance workers, whatever it is, to have all of that, to have only one not be approved for hiring. Now, I understand the pulse issue. I think that's valid. Is our workforce happy? Is turnover increasing? What might be the cause of that? That's all great. And I understand the board's interest in staying within the budget so that we can maintain our no-tax position, no-tax increase position. But, you know, I serve at the pleasure of the board, and if the process has to change, you know, I'm willing to change it in whatever way. You Councillor Mielke, appear to want to go back to the exact system we had before.
I thought that might be easiest. If we'll share that maybe next week and see what the other cost is. I was just a suggestion.
If I can just say something here, Mark. You're a get-it-done guy, and you're doing an excellent job with a very effective team. We don't want to cripple you or make work or somehow inconvenience the process of doing what needs to be done. Perhaps the old way, by the time it got to us, they'd already gone through some processes behind the scenes with the vacancy review committee, and some of those didn't make through there. The oversight that was already behind the scenes before it got to us worked pretty well. I'm not suggesting that we go back to that. In fact, it may be that we do need something, but I look to your recommendation as to what would fill that gap that would allow a streamlined, simple, informative process that's not burdensome, yet informative to us, that would allow us to be able to not feel like we're in the dark,
okay,
that we're a team. But there's really two parts to this. One is, what do we do now to catch up? Because I'm not comfortable with a couple dozen new positions that showed up on our job opportunities page, because I don't know anything about any of them, and I need to know.
Right. I'm going to come, and I'll sit with each of you and talk about every single one of those.
Yes. And can I ask
the easiest?
They're relatively new, and I know some of them are in process at various stages, but I don't want to put a monkey wrench in the works. But at the same time, I don't want this thing to sail through because we're waiting to talk with you about these and then discover that, well, that one's already filled. So it is, in my eyes, very timely, because I don't want to hold things up. But it's also very timely. I don't want them in some position that got filled and after the fact we discovered, like, oh, why don't we talk about this because there's a better way or something. So the catch-up, if we can pause just long enough, be able to help us understand what those positions are, and you'll have, I think, we'll have a lot more confidence in the overall process that we're all being good stewards. If we can get a check mark next to each one of those things that says they're good, and just at that point, maybe talk about the leftovers and the exceptions that are, have some reservations. Is that okay?
Yeah, that works.
I'm good.
Okay. You okay with that, Jeannie? Okay. All right. Thank you, Tom. And that's the immediate thing is, let's catch up and make sure that we're up to speed on the same wavelength now. And then that'll give us some insight to be able to consider what's the best process. And Mark, you can help us to know what you recommend going forward. Okay.
I just didn't know about the catch up part. It'd be kind of difficult. Maybe a summary of what where the majority came from, or
I think each one of us would do a one-on-one with Mark,
okay,
and we have
different
ways that we're all looking at it with a different set of eyes. I have a different set of things I'm interested in. I'm interested in specifics. And some of us, it's good if they have interested in patterns and general things.
Okay.
Okay, thanks, Tom. You're up.
I'm still up. I got one thing I threw in here that I just noticed on my email when I came in. I read an email of a public notice that the city of Ridgefield was starting to do their comp plan and plan to have it done by April 2016. And I was very, very concerned about that because they've already given us their proposed growth and plan, and we've had our staff do all this work, and we have hired outside help to do the EIS and whatnot. Please read that on the email and see if.
But the final adoption would be in about that period of time. Did they specifically say we're still taking applications?
Yeah. Take a look. Take a look. Okay. I was under the impression that they were doing a public announcement to have input for their plan.
Sounds like an update.
I hope that's what it was, because all I can imagine going back, Oliver has already started with an addendum to the EIS that he already did in our behalf. I hate
another
to go back.
Addendum? What, past alternative four?
No.
Oh, okay. To include alternative four. Okay. I don't want to do it again, so double check and see what you have, if you got the same email.
Actually, I think all three of us got that very, very general news update.
I just got
update.
It today, yes.
Yeah, and, but yeah, I think it's just enough for us, for me to say, I don't know enough about
so,
this.
Well, what is it?
Is this just simply relating to the citizens, what's in the works? Or are they suggesting that, well, we open it back up and you tell us what changes you want us to make? Certainly the adoption of a locally preferred alternative that's coming up here is something that allows for fine-tuning and making things better. But it sounds like we need to be able to communicate with them and find out more what they have in mind so that we're all on the same wavelength. I'm assuming they're not offering any surprises to us.
Well, they're not alone. Every city in the county, I think, needs to submit an update.
Yeah, we have them all.
Yeah. Well, we haven't received anything specific from anybody. The last I, no news is good news, I assume.
In our room.
So just consider that each one of the cities, just like the county, has separate components that they have to deal with. Each of the cities has their own capital facilities plan, their own parks plan, and things like that.
That's
that they do
is.
On the individual basis that aren't related to what we do jointly. Okay. So that might be entirely what they're talking about.
Can you say something?
Yes. I'm very interested about something you added in that comment, which was, when it comes to us, we'll be able to tweak it or what? I didn't know what
to
you
make it better, fine-tune it.
Yeah. So tell me what you would envision that might be.
Sure. As I understand it, the proposal that has gone is being analyzed right now, and what that notebook that's going to come back, the EIS, is going to be based on what was considered draft to them. It's a proposal.
Right.
And when that comes back, was it July or August that's supposed to come back?
Mm-hmm.
When that comes back, then we have a 45 day review that we need to be able to get an update on. And the path forward, as I understand it, is to read the impacts and the concerns and look at the various components that made up the possible cake, the ingredients that were to make the cake, and allow us to fine-tune and optimize what was a draft. In other words, this isn't just an exercise to create a notebook and then proceed with what was just simply a foregone conclusion. Instead, that EIS is to inform us of how to make it better. So hopefully we'll have the opportunity to optimize things, fine-tune things to address those concerns before it gets finally adopted. Is that how you understand it, Peter?
Yes, just like you said, you get to see how it was analyzed environmentally so you can see, well, this proposal had this effect, and we don't want to go that far, so we'll change our plan to submit it
to
for the final
things.
Peter
draft.
Is not the person to ask that question to. That would be Oliver, because you have far more limited experience in land use. So
well, this was just a general question about the process.
Because Oliver's not here, and because I know Peter spent a lot of time, I also gained some insight from him. He's usually right.
So when we say fine-tune, my interest is a number of people have gone to individual council members who had a property difficulty past alternative four that were within the jurisdictional boundaries of other jurisdictions. It could be land that was in urban holding. It could be, and we heard from some of those folks early on, it could be somebody in Ridgefield that believed they were brought into the urban growth boundary by mistake and want to come back out. It could be the folks out in Battleground who were brought into an urban growth boundary and were asking us to create a remedy to bypass their city's jurisdictions and to use our legislative authority to do a fix. And somebody, I couldn't figure out who, had been telling them, bring it to your individual counselors because they can clean this up at the end.
City did.
What I've said is, huh?
It was the city. The city of Ridgefield told them to get a hold of us. Then when it comes to us, and we can't move the urban growth boundary.
We can't move their urban growth boundary, so we can sympathize with that complication. Mm-hmm. And in Battleground, if someone has been put into Battleground's urban growth boundary, what I have told people, go back to Battleground, because if they send us a letter saying, gee, we made a mistake in our mapping, mm-hmm. We don't want our urban growth boundary to include this cluster development, then I don't know what we can do about it, but we certainly couldn't even think about it until we'd get a communication.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
And so there are several of those situations. So I want to have an understanding so that we're all telling people the same thing. First of all, we don't have any legal authority to do those kind of tweaks. So is that what you meant? I just want to know.
Citizens that have turned in a tax ID number saying, I want to be able to have, if you're going to do something, this is my preference for my piece of property, we've directed them to add their property to a list in planning. And so planning is built in, has been just accumulating individual requests that have come from citizens. And I don't know what that list is, but they need to be able to have build a list somewhere, that public record. So that's what they're doing.
And what is it we expect planning to do with that? What planning would normally do, which is accumulate that list, and then as we go into annual updates, look to see if that person's request could be included as part of an annual update, or if the person can pay fees if it's not staff generated. If a property owner wants to generate it, they can pay certain fees and ask for that modification. And then it goes through a planning process, mm-hmm. and the planning commission
comes to us. Yeah, I think you're mixing up. I think you were talking about the EIS on the proposed mm-hmm. comprehensive plan. So you're right. We are getting these people wanting to say, what can I do? So
no, I understand.
Everyone's a little
that
different.
Difference.
Yeah, everyone's a little different. And under the alternatives that we're accepting and the environmental impact statement is being studied, it's being studied on the direction that we want to go. It's not going to change or make smaller lots on someone's piece of property. It's going to enable them to do that. Unless you already have smaller lots.
Yeah, I'm not talking about that. If somebody has a difficult property and mm-hmm. they have been advised to give their name and their tax ID lot number to planning, that's so that planning can work with them and see what can be done legally.
Yes.
And then mm-hmm. they may submit a request, they
yeah.
may not.
But
that's
it's a different thing, kind of.
Unless... what I'm worried about are the number of people that came to me and said, well, I hear that the commissioners, when you vote on the comp plan, you can just change my property for me, even if I'm in somebody else's urban growth boundary.
Well, it has already been changed prior to 1994. So if they had a legal lot in 1994, I mean, but we said no, you have to have 20 acres. So therefore, you can't divide those.
These are different kinds of problems. Mm. It's people that want to redesignate land or want to come out of an urban growth boundary, ended up in a city limits that there was they got mapped over. You know, whatever. Right. What I'm asking is a real simple question. Mm. And probably Chris Horn needs to answer this. It's my understanding from a few years of planning experience that the jurisdictions these folks are in need to remedy the problem if it's going to be remedied, or they need to make a request to us in some form to do that. But I don't know if any of us believe that when we get to approving the final EIS or amending what we requested or selecting an alternative, that we don't do a bunch of add-ons at the tail end of that as part of our final approval for these things that are entirely outside of the box, that we don't really have any legal authority to make changes on.
I don't believe we're doing that.
Okay.
You recall when the mayors of each of the small cities came forward and they said, we want you to draw a line 1 mile around all of the urban growth boundaries and just say, those are all large lots. And to me, that's not realistic.
Well, that may have happened before I came, I don't think there's any legal precedence for... They can ask all they want, but I don't believe there's a legal precedence for us doing it.
Well, here's how I think the appropriate path forward is. I think we still have the responsibility for us to consider the EIS as it comes back, and that is intended to inform us of what's good and what's bad about the ingredients for the cake, and we are to pay attention to that. And they'll say, this is a little out of balance there, you need to be able to do that, a little out of balance there, you need to do that. It's not a validation process of yes or no, take it or leave it as a whole. It's to inform us to ensure that the process ends up with the right informed decisions at the end. So what I think would be the most appropriate response to the mayors, rather than say, well, 1 mile around this is everything's going to be large lots, instead would be to encourage them to get out their colored pencil. They know their area better than we do. All the small cities know their what's inside their urban growth boundary, and they're the best ones to be able to identify the far future, what they want to see outside the urban growth boundary. But they to just simply say something that's so general as I want big lots everywhere, they could already have neighborhoods that they would violate because they're already developed. So the specific response by the mayors outside the urban growth boundary would be get your colored pencil out and say, well, this area here is big, and yet we're proposing that it be small, and that area there and that area there. In other words, give us something more tangible and specific as to what works for you that's real and it matches up with the parcelization that exists out there now. That would be the responsible way, and that we ought to consider the requests by those city mayors in order to make it better.
Well, and we've already done that.
They haven't.
We've done that where they created, they're the ones that either annex or expand their urban growth boundary. They're the ones that submit the request if they want to make a change.
Mm-hmm.
It comes through the comp plan.
They're not proposing to change the urban growth boundary. Instead, what they're proposing, what their main concern was, is in the far future, that urban growth boundary will eventually move out, right? And when it does, they want to be able to, in the far future, consider that they may have a 10 or a 20-acre parcel out there that would accommodate large businesses. And if it just ends up being divided up into residential lots, then as you move that urban growth boundary, all they're going to get is residences.
But that's why they have the ability to expand their urban growth boundary for any reasonable decision they want to make. And if they can make a case for it and they give it to us, we wouldn't reject that. And they can even, if it goes in their urban growth boundary, they'll give it a land use designation in the broad sense.
That happened in the past. And the hearings board threw out many of them. So they over-requested. Le Center is a good
example.
Yeah, they over-requested. Le Center is a good example when they wanted to bring in the west side of the interchange. And the hearings board came back and says, you can't do that.
Okay, so what I was looking for here mm-hmm. was when you were saying fine-tune and optimize, mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure I wasn't hearing that we're going to go outside of an orderly plan and that we're going to have a process and we're going to have some order and people submitting stuff kind of after the fact wanting us to tweak a map or tweak a property designation. I think if we open the box on that, we'll never finish this comp plan.
We're not doing that. We don't have we don't have ability to do that.
I don't think we do. But I just, when I heard fine-tune and optimize, my alarm bell went off.
No, he meant the EIS. So when the EIS comes back and gives us the pros and cons, we could accept that, try to tweak it to make it better and less challengeable. Anything that it's kind of a preview before we go to the hearings board.
Understood.
Okay.
Understood.
Okay, that was. Were we still on 2.3?
No, we were in councilor reports.
Oh, and whose was that?
Tom's. Excuse me, Councilor.
It started off with the email. It started off with the email. I don't know how we got into that.
Well, it was a good discussion. What else you got?
That's it.
That was.
Nothing.
Peter?
Do you have one thing I'd like to tie up? This was from a couple months ago. You appointed Councilor Stewart to the Washington Investment Board. This was just a
for Columbia River Gorge only.
For the Columbia River Gorge. This is just the definition that goes on your grid. I reviewed this with Councilor Stewart, and she approved me bringing it to the board time for your approval. The blue, you can't see those, but those will be hyperlinks that'll be on the website that lead people to more information. So there's more behind this, but Councilor Stewart felt that this accurately.
I have a concern. So
okay.
This Washington Investment Board mm-hmm. will send them through to Skamania County EDC, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It will send them to the state of Washington.
That's correct.
Skamania County
EDC has a page dedicated under their website to the Washington Investment Board.
So.
And we haven't had a meeting. And as far, I haven't even seen a schedule for a meeting.
So this is all part of the Gorge Commission?
It is not part of the Gorge Commission, but it's associated with the same regional boundaries as the Gorge Commission on both sides of the river.
Yes.
So we have a list of boards and commissions. Where does this go?
I didn't know this.
This is a 7-member board.
I mean, what do we do with this?
This just goes on the grid for the board assignments for the three councilors.
You remember the multi-page document that has a little colored rectangles?
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those items.
Okay. Is that published as a page in a?
I believe it's
I thought it was a document.
It's on a document. Some of them we have on the website. I'll see if they're hyperlinked, but this
would
go on that document.
It would be good to be able to put that online.
I'll talk to Eleni about that.
Okay.
Were all online.
So I'll double check.
That you could.
That'd be handy.
I know that all the other boards and commissions are. Yeah. I'll have to verify the councilor assignments.
Yeah. So this would go, if we had it, this would go there.
Yes.
Okay.
So these are the liabilities on the Columbia River?
Well, this specific board, when the Columbia Gorge National Scenic Act was passed, they gave $15 million to each state to use for economic development projects on each side of the river.
Mm-hmm.
So there's three counties on the Washington side, three counties on the Oregon side, and each of them has a seven-member board. In addition, they meet jointly as the bi-state advisory committee, and all they deal with is economic development. So that's how it's separate from the Columbia Gorge Commission. They deal with the regulation of building and permits and that kind of thing. This is to promote economic development.
In what region?
This is the Washington side of the river, so this is actually all of the Washington grants have been in Skamania County. So there's a little sliver in Klickitat County and a little sliver in Clark County. We actually have members on this board, but all of the projects that have been granted by the Washington Investment Board have been in Skamania.
So the Washington Investment Board gives to a number of boards. And then
they don't give out to boards, they give out to local governments or businesses that apply for outright grants to municipalities or loans for economic development.
Just in the Columbia River Gorge,
that was my
designated
question.
Area only.
Okay, that was
my
question.
They allowed anything
what
there.
Yeah. What
that's
you're thinking
that's
of
confusing,
is
yeah.
There is
right.
Another state board
wow.
called the Washington Investment Board.
Okay.
That is the board that handles all the PERS retirement money mm-hmm. and all of the big pools of state money.
Yeah, that wasn't my concern. I was thinking, the state is handing out $15 million for economic development.
No.
I'm thinking, and who's on the receiving end of that list? Yeah. How do we get on that list?
So, and it was a one-time
there's
amount.
There's free money there. Right?
Yeah, it was a one-time amount given by the federal government. It's down to, I think their fund balance is about $250,000, but they still have some loans that they're receiving payback on, so I don't know exactly what their balance is, but they do have an annual report that's on the website that's linked here.
So you sit on that board. They haven't had any meetings yet?
Well, I think I got appointed in February or March, mm-hmm. and when we heard about it, we were in. It came to I don't know somebody. I think it came to you, as a matter of fact, and mm-hmm. you asked Peter to research and find
yeah.
out.
Kelly
you and Tom
Sills
said
sat on
I should
board
do
previously.
It. Kelly Sills used to be the designated person.
Okay. So and have you been done?
So. We're watching to see when the meetings are. I did receive a nice, right after we wrote to them and saying I was designated, a nice welcoming letter to the group. But Skamania County, you know, it's a smaller county, and they have several people do a lot of different things. So mm-hmm. it's
so that $15 million was statewide. So Skamania County got a slice of that one time. And it's not an annual amount that's coming in.
No, it's not an annual amount.
So
and it was a one-time amount. It's not statewide. It's just for the three counties in the Columbia Gorge.
$15 million?
For yes.
25 left.
But again,
they gave $15 million.
The federal government.
Federal government. Scenic.
But again, this was when the National Scenic Act was passed
National
in the
scenic.
90s.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So that fund has been diminished down because they've given a lot of it out as grants.
I'm really curious if we can get a report to see how the world did they spend
$14.75 million.
I can send you the link to
mitigation money because yeah. when they designated the area, it put all kinds of constraints and controls.
Yeah, we know about that.
They do have an annual report that shows every grant that they've given out since its inception.
Okay.
So I'll be anxious to see when they have a meeting and what information there is around it.
Could you get a list of what they spent that money on and share it with us?
Well, if I ever get it.
Before the meeting?
I can send you the link to their report.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Or I can print it out, whichever you prefer.
Yeah.
Share it with us, yeah.
Good work. Thank you.
The board
is
assignments
that link
are
here?
On
no.
the web page?
Yes, I'm aware of that.
The link is off of this
what's that?
Web
we don't
page,
have things like this in there.
We change the picture there?
Yeah, we need a more current one. He looks like he's 47 in this photo.
Yeah. That's going to be Genie.
You know, when they did that picture, it's like they had 8-bit color or something.
Oh.
Did you Google it?
So the lists are there and links to the websites are there.
On the individual
but
sites.
But a
right.
description, you know, that document, we might want to get that document on there.
Okay. I'll touch base with
that'd
one
be
on it.
Then we see. When they, you know, the like we had when we first assigned them, the when they meet, how often they meet, that kind of where they meet, that kind of thing. Okay, thank you very much, Peter. Anything
so
else?
That's approved as a definition?
Oh, yes, that's fine.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
That's all I have.
Mark, you got anything?
No, thanks for the trip to the woodshed. Other than that, I'm done.
That's on Grandma's behalf. She wants me to make sure that you're a thrifty spender.
All right, nothing else.
Okay. Motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second. All in favor? Adjourned. Thanks.